stay for another week right there. Broke my neck. Yeah, this thing has wheels. That's a bad idea.
Okay.
I have returned. Try and contain your excitement. That was a joke. Just a couple of reminders and announcements. First homework for grades are posted as of this morning, right? And the solutions as well. If you have any questions about that stuff, I'm sure happy to answer them, or myself, although he graded it. So. Number two, there will be another Python hangout thing a week from today. Time, I don't remember, but whatever it says on wherever that was posted. I'm sure Carrie and Robbie will post reminders, but that will probably likely be in here again. I heard the one last week went well, for those of you who were there. So they're doing another one, for those of you who want to do it again or couldn't make it last time.
5 to 7.
5 to 7?
Yes.
Okay.
Or this one.
5 to 7 on Monday the 29th, which is a different time slot, to be sure, from 2 to 4 p.m. on a Friday. And then lastly, we are less than a month from the final exam, right? There's 4 classes left, including today. We still have lots to talk about. Hopefully we get through moons, asteroids, comets, and tiny stuff today. Wednesday, we will talk about atmospheres and like gas giants, which will probably bleed into Monday. And then the last day, we'll talk about exoplanets, and how you find them, and what you might be interested in looking for. And that will round us out for the semester. And the final is on, December 15th from noon to 3. So if you have an issue with that, and you haven't already contacted undergraduate studies, do that now. Because it's the last day, and it sucks. I think it's the last day anyway. It is. So, hooray for us. Not the last day for 2022, I can tell you that. Any questions before we jump in to stuff for today? Mark?
Are we trying to do the observatory again?
We will make an attempt at some point between the last day of class and the exam. We'll all look at reading days and stuff and see when would be a good day to do it, but weather is going to be the main problem at this point. I think no one that reserved the telescope last week got to use it, so we're in that season now. But we'll try. Okay, so I wanted to start off by talking about moons. They're sort of the in-between objects between planets and other smaller things. So the four big moons of Jupiter are sort of the, Ray talked about our moon last time. So, it's a moon, it's a good moon, it's ours, we like it. It's sort of roughly comparable in size to Jupiter's 4 large moons, most of which you have seen through the telescope. If you were there for the last telescope night, you saw some of these moons. Here is a small table of some of their various properties. So, the 4 Galilean moons, they were discovered by Galileo, hence the name Galilean satellites, in 1610, and they were named after some rich Italian girls, I don't know. They're Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, in order from closest to Jupiter to furthest away from Jupiter, but not in order of size. So Io is, in terms of our moon, Io is about 20% more massive and 10% larger in size, which gives a density of about 3,500 kilograms per cubic meter. Europa is a little less massive and a little smaller than our moon, and its density is around 3,000 kilograms per cubic meter. Ganymede is the biggest. It's the biggest moon in the solar system. It's the 9th biggest object in the solar system, so it's bigger than Mercury, which is a planet. So if Ganymede were floating around by itself, it would probably be called planet. It's twice as massive as our moon and 50% larger by radius, but its density is pretty low. It's 1,900 kilograms per cubic meter. And then Callisto is sort of the next biggest of all these at 50% more massive and 40% larger, but it has the lowest density of all of them at 1,800. So that seems backwards, actually. But anyway, those numbers, density numbers, don't make sense to me for some reason. As a quick comparison here, just some of the basic densities that might go into explaining why these densities change. Iron, just like if you imagine a chunk of iron, right, that's 7,000 kilograms per cubic meter. A chunk of rock, like you'd go down to the beach and pick up some rocks, right, that's 3,000 kilograms per cubic meter. And ice, like water, regular old water ice, is about 1,000 kilograms per cubic meter, right? So as you talked about last week, right, Earth has sort of a mixed composition. It's got iron and rocks and some water on top of it, you know, as the oceans, right? So Earth's average density is 5,500 kilograms per cubic meter, which sort of puts these other things in context, right? So if you imagine that these four moons are composed of some combination of rocks, ice, and iron, based on these densities, what do you expect the dominant components of some of these moons to be? Talk about it for a second. What do we think? Any ideas? Gary, you had your hand up before we discussed.
Yeah, maybe like Europa and Io are more dense. They probably have a lot more iron than rock is. Maybe because Io is more dense, I guess it's much more massive though. You could have some more iron versus Europa.
Right, you can sort of imagine the things that are a little bit more dense have more of those dense materials in them. So there's going to be less ice, maybe some more rock, maybe a little bit more iron in there, right? Whereas things that are closer to 1,000 are going to be composed mostly of ice. Sophia?
I have a question.
Yes?
It doesn't have to do with density.
Okay.
Is there anything that, like, characterizes moons as opposed to, like, planets or planetesimals besides their size?
Yes. They orbit something bigger.
But, like, that's all. Like,
that's
nothing about
that itself. Yeah. Something is a satellite of something else if it's orbiting something bigger than itself. Or roughly, you know. The Pluto system, right, has things that are sort of roughly the same size orbiting each other. So you put one's a little bit smaller, so you call it the moon, I guess. Steve?
Is it also significant that Io is almost twice the mass of Europa with only a negligible amount of radial difference?
Is that significant?
Yeah, for like density, because it looks like it's only 500 kilograms per cubic meter greater, but it's like twice the stuff.
Yeah, I mean, remember like volume scales, right? When we talk about density, we're talking about volume and mass, not
yep.
necessarily radius, right? So volume is scaling a little bit differently, as you know, 1/r³.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Right, for density. So this is why I think I have the numbers in the wrong order here. Let's go on to the next slide.
They're correct.
There are?
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay. Well, let's look at the actual theorized interior structure of these four moons. Maybe we can piece together why. So I guess that makes sense. Here we go. Here are some interior models, right? So what we have here is, this is sort of not color-coded or anything really by anything interesting, but the dark parts are the denser pieces. So when we say dense core here for Io and Europa, that probably means iron or dense rocks. So that's probably what's bringing those numbers up. Whereas for Ganymede and Callisto, the central part here of Ganymede is a mud or rock, mud meaning mixed with water, or just solid rock, where it maybe doesn't have any iron in there. So if you have mostly just rock and ice, where which ice is this other stuff here, mixed in with small bits of rock. And then Callisto is basically just a mix of ice and small pieces of rock. You can sort of see how you have those different densities. Really, frankly, the two interesting moons here are Europa and Io for a lot of different reasons. Europa mostly because if you see here, we have a very thick layer here of liquid water that's at roughly a reasonable temperature for things to live in. And so Europa has been sort of the main place we think we should look in the solar system for other life besides like Mars, right? But if you have water, you have pretty much all the building blocks for life. So if you can get through a 100 kilometer thick sheet of ice and get yourself into an ocean, you can get a little submarine going and look for, I don't know, shrimp or something. Sophia?
So that 100 kilometers is referring to the ice?
I think the roughly sort of there's a equal proportion of ice on top of a sheet of water that are more or less roughly the same size.
So are they like around each, around 50?
The water is about 100 kilometers thick. That's a deep ocean, right? I mean, Earth's oceans are a few miles deep.
I think it's about 2 or 3 times more water on Europa than on Earth.
Yes. And that's on a thing that's the size of the moon, right? So like, you know, if you're thirsty. So all you young people who are trying to solve climate change, maybe we should just go live in Europa's ocean. Joanne?
Do you know how deep we've dug on Earth? Like, is it realistic that you think we might be able to go there and somehow do that?
What's the deepest we've, like, 10 kilometers or something?
Yeah, the Marianas Trench is like 11 kilometers deep.
So
that's the deepest part of the ocean, but I think the hole that we've drilled that's the deepest is like 10 kilometers deep.
So it's going to be a while before we ever think it to end.
Yeah, like, so you can sort of imagine when you talk about, like, crust and mantle, right? You haven't even gotten 10% of it. And that's a tenth of that thickness of ice. Now, granted, ice is easier to get through than rock, because you can melt it pretty easily.
Like cool your bit and stuff too.
And you know,
yeah,
it's more feasible to do that than it is to drill into the mantle on Earth for lots of reasons. I'm not saying it's easy, right? I'm saying it's easier by some factor, but people are thinking about that problem, right? As an actual, like, how could we actually do this?
So kind of a follow-up question to that. Is Europa geologically active at all, do we know?
There may be some form of like plate tectonics with ice sheets on water, but not in the same way that Io is, actually. Io is the most volcanic body in the solar system.
All those cracks on the surface of Europa in that picture, those are cracks of ice that were created as those ice sheets are slightly moving and whatnot.
So
right.
That would be...
And then, like, the reddish color is, like, organic compounds and stuff.
Europa is really cool. I'm sad that that's the extent that we get to talk about it in this class. And then all these, like, this, like, pizza-looking thing, all the pepperoni-type guys, right, those are volcanoes, right? So Io is just constantly spewing stuff out into space. It's highly volcanic because it has this interior structure that is kept hot because it's close enough to Jupiter that Jupiter is just constantly squeezing and pulling it and not letting it settle down and cool. So it has this, just, it's just all this liquid rock in there. Sophia.
So last time we talked about how, like, generally planets at some point are, like, geologically active, like the interior is,
yeah,
is warm, and then they either cool down or they don't,
huh?
Depending on, like,
yep,
stuff. So where are these guys at on there?
So these are, right, these are all, Ganymede is sort of roughly the same size as Mercury, and it's, you know, Mercury is not active anymore, past shrinking a little bit. Ganymede is gonna be cool. It's not active, right? You can look at the picture of it. It's craters. There's nothing going on. Callisto is more or less the same thing. Io is maintaining its volcanic activity because of its proximity to the biggest planet in the solar system, and it's also the smallest moon. So it's more driven by tides than anything else. And Europa isn't really geologically active the same way. Right, so Earth and Venus are really the only two that are left in the solar system that could be geologically active the way we think about Earth being geologically active. Steve?
That tidal force, is that the word for, like, the gravitational manipulation that Jupiter is doing on Io?
Yes.
Got it.
Tidal force. All right. Let's talk about Saturn's biggest moon, Titan. This is the second biggest moon in the solar system. So it goes, I think, Ganymede, Titan, Earth's moon. No, I guess Callisto. It's Earth's moon is fourth or fifth. Titan is interesting because it has a thick atmosphere. But it's not an atmosphere that you'd want to breathe because it's made of pretty much exclusively methane, which, not fun, right? It has some nitrogen, some argon, and then it has ethane, propane, other organic molecules. Do not take a match to Titan. That would be very bad. It would be like the end of a disastrous episode of King of the Hill or something. One laugh. All right. It has a really thick atmosphere, right? So its surface pressure is pretty high. It's 50% more pressure than it is on the surface of the Earth. So 1.5 atmospheres. But it's also really cold. It's 94 Kelvin. And so you sort of, that's interesting for Titan because that puts 94 Kelvin is close to the triple point of methane. So a triple point is where you have solid, liquid, and gas all at the same time. So that means that you can have methane gas, methane liquid, and methane ice all at the same time, which means that you get things like methane lakes and rivers, methane rain, methane snow, right? You have this, like I said, this is not a fun place to be. So you can see, right, if you didn't know that this was a picture of Titan from above, taken from one of the lander that went with the Cassini probe, you might say, oh, that's just an aerial photograph somewhere on Earth, right? Those are methane rivers on Titan. Methane lakes and oceans. This is super interesting to us to try and explore, right? These are organic molecules. This is another place you might look for life. So we're sending, this is actually a real thing that's being launched. It's a drone, quadcopter thing. And they're going to send it to Titan to fly around and do fun stuff. Launches in 2027. So, all you aerospace engineers, let me know how it goes. Sophia?
Yeah. What do you call yourself if, like, this is what you study? Is that planetary science?
Yeah, probably. That's probably the closest thing.
Also, I probably should know this, but could, which whose moon is this?
This is Saturn's moon. Sorry. I don't remember if I said Saturn out loud, but this is Saturn's largest moon. Joanne.
So do they think that there could be life there that, like, relies on...
Not anything that we can recognize.
But, like, that rely... Like, something...
Yeah, maybe.
That would rely on methane, like how we rely on water.
Yeah, maybe. Why not? You know? We'll talk... On the last day, we'll talk a little bit about, like, life, right? And sort of our idea of what that is based on what we are, right? But it could be literally anything. We have no idea. So we just look for what we know. But who knows? All right. So those are moons, right? We've talked about the interesting ones. There's dozens of moons
around most of the planets, except in, you know, the outer planets. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune all have dozens of moons. The inner solar system has three, right? Our moon, and then Mars has two little ones. I would say most of the moons sort of fall along the lines of Mars is two little space potato guys, right? They're just asteroids that got captured or things that didn't quite end up as round spherical shapes. So let's talk about asteroids, right? Because that's sort of the next class of thing that we're going to be looking at.
Asteroids are small, rocky bodies. They're mostly found, so when I say small, rocky bodies, I mean sort of in that ballpark of like 3,000, 3,500 kilograms per cubic meter density, right? Small, rocky bodies, mostly they're found between Jupiter and Mars in what we call the asteroid belt. That's where most of them live, on roughly circular orbits. Here's a diagram. Showing the positions of most of the known asteroids bigger than some threshold size. On the first day of 2003, arbitrary. So here's Earth, Mars, and Jupiter. There's the asteroid belt. And then you see here there are two other big populations that sort of are on Jupiter's orbit in front of and behind. Those are called Trojan asteroids. Those are caught in places along Jupiter's orbit called Lagrange points. Basically, if you drew an equilateral triangle between the Sun, that point in the middle, and Jupiter, that would all fit in with the 60-degree triangle there. So that's where the gravity is balanced between the two. They sort of fit. So they just follow Jupiter around. So there's a picture of an asteroid. It's a space potato, right? But what are asteroids?
That's a picture?
That's a picture.
Cool.
It's a real picture of a real asteroid. What are they, right? They're chunks of rock, right? But why are they there? Think sort of back to the idea of how the solar system formed, right? Why are they there? How did they get there? Why aren't they somewhere else? Talk about it for a second.
So you have the
by 20 kilometers, I think.
Cool.
I have the dimensions.
Cool.
So it wasn't
the
one
spot,
but
we
have to convince you just like,
got
a potato from the storm.
Like
literal
picture.
How often is it that they have like ice?
Ice?
Or like anything cool, or most of them just weird clumps?
I would say asteroids, most of them are going to be inside the ice
layer.
so that's inside the frost lines, which I think
oh, yeah.
Must be great. So they're going to generally not have too much ice on the surfaces because you'll get in pockets that are not exposed to the sun and stuff. But by composition, they're mostly just going to be rock and iron. They might have ice inside somewhere. But.
So it has like craters on it?
Yeah.
So it's been hit by other stuff?
Oh, yeah.
So then we can kind of date it, right?
Plus or minus a few billion years, sure.
Well, just like how we do with the planets.
Yes. Yeah. You can do relative dating, not necessarily absolute.
Is it really plus or minus billions? Or is it like plus or minus billions?
Give or take a billion here or there, you know, how does it really matter?
It's not for a kid. It was made Tuesday,
I know, I'm just asking billions versus like because we talked about the planets.
Plus or minus a few 500 million years.
Yeah, sure.
Because,
like,
so called a billion, you know?
But they're already billions of years old, and that's way longer than what we're talking about.
What you have to understand about error bars in astronomy is that they're usually really big. Because it's really hard to tell absolute, precise dates for things.
I know.
Right? So.
Until we put something on the surface and it can do radiometric dating. If we're just doing crater counts, it's inaccurate. We get a guess, but it's not that accurate.
Yeah, I understand that. I'm just saying because we were talking about the planets and then like how part of them is smooth and has no craters, then you know it's like younger than the part that's covered with craters, but like plus
right.
or minus a billion just confused me because the planets themselves are only a few billion. So like
But that's what I mean, right?
Minus that error bar then it's like gone. So that's why I was just wondering what the order of magnitude was. Yeah.
I understand.
I've read something once, like saying that sometimes they just round pi to 1. Is that true? Like in some of these calculations.
If I'm gonna round pi, I'm gonna round it to 3.
Okay.
But some people probably do that. Yeah. What are asteroids? I mean, besides just being chunks of rock and iron. Where did they come from, Mark? Yeah, I mean, it's things that didn't end up in a planet, basically, right? It's if you imagine a pile of Legos that you built together to make a planet, they're the ones that didn't make it into the fully constructed set, right? So, this is material that was never able to form a planet. It's just not, there's not enough mass there to make a planet-sized thing. So if you look at the size distribution of asteroids that we know about, we're still finding them all the time, right? They're just tiny little chunks of rock. But if you look at the size distribution, it roughly follows a 1 over r squared distribution. So the smaller you get, the more of them there are. The biggest one we know about, it's called Ceres. 900 kilometers big, large. It's big, right? We used to think it was a planet. It's not a planet anymore. There are only 26 asteroids total that we know about that are bigger than 200 kilometers in size. So big ones are pretty rare, right? Things that are really honking huge, they're not around a lot. Sophia.
Two quick things. Is the 900 kilometers, is that a radius or like a...
That is probably a diameter.
Okay, and then, so just for context for the 26, like what is the bottom of that fraction, like order of magnitude?
Oh, there's thousands, hundreds of thousands of asteroids that we know about. Eric?
So with Ceres, is there a particular, like how would it...
It was the first asteroid discovered.
Okay.
Because it also happens to be the biggest.
At what point would it just be a dwarf planet?
I think we do call Ceres a dwarf planet.
Okay, it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think
so it's kind of
it's the
only round object.
Yeah,
the
right. The trick for being a dwarf planet is that you are spherical.
Okay.
And not a space potato.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So here's this one right here. It's called Ida. It's 60 kilometers by 20 kilometers, so I was off by a factor of 50%.
if you took all the asteroids in the asteroid belt and put and tried to make a planet out of them, you would have less mass than Earth's moon. So this is not a significant amount of mass, right? It's not a dense, particularly dense place. It might look like there's lots going on there, right? But if space is big, right, these are not the actual sizes of Earth and Mars and Jupiter, right? Those are just showing you where they are, right? This is, you could fly through it and not see an asteroid. It's not like in Star Wars where they try and, you know, maybe there's big space worms in them, but, you know, it's not like that, right? It's low density compared to what we think of, right? However, 10 to 30% of asteroids have a moon, meaning that they have another little asteroid orbiting around them. So this is one example, right? Ida has a little moon called Dactyl orbiting around it. So if that's 60 by 20 kilometers, that's what, like 2 or 3 kilometers diameter? Tiny little thing. I have a piece of asteroid that I would like to share with you. This is an iron meteorite. It's a slice through it, right? So you can sort of see this is what the inside of an asteroid would look like. So pass it around. Don't drop it, it's expensive. And watch the edges, they're maybe a little sharp. So enjoy that. It's heavy, right? This is iron, right? So this is what 7,000 kilograms per cubic meter feels like. Steve.
You said the meteor, like what an asteroid becomes a meteor when it hits our atmosphere.
Oh geez. Okay, what is the it's meteors? Okay, so there's meteoroids, meteors, meteorites.
Meteor is entering the
atmosphere. Meteor is in the atmosphere. Meteoroid is in space. And meteorite is on the ground.
Meteoroid, though, has to be guaranteed that it will hit our atmosphere.
Not necessarily.
So are all asteroids meteoroids?
In theory, it's more of, I think we'd say more, it's more about size, right? If you said something was big enough to be an asteroid, it's...
Okay.
Meteoroids are not existential threats, let's put it that way.
Got it.
You would not care particularly much about a meteoroid in here. You would care about an asteroid.
I mean, that the fireball that blew up over Russia back in 2013, the size of a tennis ball.
Oh.
And it like shattered windows.
Yeah.
Most of the meteors you see streaking across the sky, like the Perseids or the Orionids, those are like the size of sand grains.
Hence the 1 over r squared size distribution, right? So you see a lot more little tiny things hitting the Earth than you do big things. Right? So that scales all the way down to the smallest size. Next up is comets. You have probably heard before the analogy of calling a comet a dirty snowball. That is roughly correct in terms of their composition. They're mostly made of water ice, just like literally just snow, basically, right? There's other stuff in there too, right? This is the dirty part. There's ammonia in there. There's some silicates, which just means like sand, basically rocks. And there's organic material in there too. So if you imagine you could sort of make a, we used to do this in class. We used to get dry ice, water ice, like just potting soil and maple syrup for the organics. And we would make comets. But dry ice is kind of dangerous, so we don't do that anymore. That's basically what it is, right? You just take a snowball, you throw some stuff on it, pack it together. There's tons of these too, right? They have sort of size distributions similar to asteroids. Some big ones, some small ones. Mostly, there's not a ton of huge ones, like there are huge asteroids. Comets are interesting though because they're on
highly elliptical orbits. They come from way out in the outer solar system. They sort of tumble down with the sun, and when they get close to the sun, they pass through that frost line that you talked about last week, and they can't have water ice anymore. And so it starts to evaporate. And that's where you get these long tails coming out of the comet as the stuff, as it literally falls apart on its orbit around the sun. Sophia?
If you're looking at the sky and you want to differentiate a comet and a meteor or whatever suffix, how do you do that?
A comet and a what?
Meteor plus appropriate suffix.
A meteor will last a second or less, and a comet will stay in the same place for a couple hours. They're not in Earth's atmosphere, right? They're orbiting the sun. So a meteor is just a quick flash in the atmosphere.
Okay, so shooting stars are meteors.
Yes. Correct. This is a picture of a comet that came through last summer. No, 2020. It was briefly visible to the naked eye if you were in a dark place. This is not my picture, but there's one coming through soon, right, Ray? It's
Comet Leonard.
Leonard.
Uh-huh.
Leonard.
Leonard.
Okay.
The guy who discovered it. His name. It should reach naked eye brightness. People are saying December 11th, December 12th, like magnitude 2 or 3.
This is always a coin toss, though.
Yeah.
So it's not by no means a guarantee.
Yeah. So, but it's a long period comet. So before it entered the area of the solar system where the planets are, it was going to take 80,000 years to complete an orbit. But this time, once it interacts with the sun's going to toss it out of the solar system. So this is your literally one and only chance to see Comet Leonard.
Comet Leonard.
Mm-hmm.
Sophia, did you have a question?
Like about that comet, for example.
Yeah.
Can you know like what hemisphere or like quadrant or whatever of the Earth will be visible on until like really, really, really right before it?
We generally have an orbit that we know it will be following. But we don't necessarily know when it will be bright enough to see. Because things, it may not get, the composition might be slightly more tilted towards rock than ice, and so it might not start to evaporate until it's too late, you know? I don't know about this one that's coming through, about Leonard. We'd have to look it up.
I think it says it's going to pass the closest to Earth on December 12th.
Yep.
It'll probably be like around the horizon. So
They're generally, usually they're at inconvenient times and places to see for whatever reason. But because they have to get close to the sun to really get going, and that, so then that puts them at sunrise or sunset. So let's talk about the structure of a comet. Basically, if you think about when a comet is in its comet phase, like this, right, where it has a tail and stuff, we sort of split it into three component parts. There's the nucleus, which is the actual like object that's orbiting around the sun. That's going to be a few kilometers in size. That's the dirty snowball part. There's the coma, which is the heated cloud of gas and dust that's evaporating off the comet. That's going to be about 10,000 kilometers in size. That's what we can see them, right? Because that's much bigger than the actual. It's big and reflective. And then the tail is a few million kilometers long. And so this is because the particles evaporate off the comet, and then they just sort of follow in an orbit. They get pushed around by things like radiation pressure, gravity pulls things around, and so that sort of trails off behind the comet. There are actually two different kinds of tails. There's an ion tail, which is pushed by the solar wind and magnetic field lines. That always points directly away from the sun. So if you imagine a comet goes around,
that the ion tail, which you can see
is the bluer one here in this picture, right, this guy here, that's the ion tail, and then the dust tail, the sort of the wider fan shaped one here, that's all the trailing particles of ice and dust and stuff, and those are pushed by radiation pressure. Sophia, did you have a question? Put your hand up.
Oh.
Is it just unconscious now?
what was my question? Oh, sure. I don't know if this is what I raised my hand for, but so just about like the composition of the ion tail.
Yeah.
In comparison to the dust tail. So they're just all just particles, but the ion one is just ionized particles.
Yeah.
But it's just like the same elements that made up, or the same like molecules.
It's gonna be stuff like, what are you doing with that, Steve?
I smelled it.
Oh, okay. You're holding it like a pizza.
Pizza time.
It's gonna be things like molecules of like gas and stuff, like nitrogen, oxygen, and stuff like that.
I never thought about comets as like coming back, but they do.
They do. So the most famous comet is Halley's Comet, right? That comes back every 78 years.
And like, is there like an average lifetime because they'll eventually like evaporate or something?
That's, so Halley's Comet is like a short period comet. I think it's getting slowly less bright every time it comes through. So I guess eventually it will not be around anymore. But most comets don't come around that often. I think 80,000 years is a lot more typical of what you'd see. So they're not going to evaporate away quickly.
What is like the semi-major axis of a long period one about?
Hundreds of AU. So let's look at a comet nucleus up close. So this is from a European probe that went out a few years ago called Rosetta. Do you remember the name of the comet, Ray?
67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko.
I'm not going to try and say that. 67P is this, it's sort of got this sort of shape, like kind of walnut shape, where it's got sort of two chunks stuck together. They're sort of glued together with ice in the middle here. And it actually landed a probe on the surface. This is the surface close up. And then this scale bar is 500 meters. So this is basically like a boulder, right? That's just a big rock or chunk of ice or something. And they landed a probe on it. It was cool. Garrett, you have a question?
So, like, I'm assuming it's large, but it's not extremely massive. So, like, if you were to be in a spacesuit and appear right there on the comet, would there be significant enough gravity that, like, if you jumped, you would be brought back down, or would
I think there's an XKCD about this. It would not be particularly significant gravity, no. You could probably jump like into orbit if you were strong enough.
I mean, we did put a lander on it, but the lander like bounced and landed in a shadowed spot, so it immediately stopped working because it couldn't pick light up anymore.
Yeah.
So it did, you know, there is not, you can't bounce around the comets.
It was hard to land on. It was really more of a crash, yeah. Yeah, I mean, but it's mostly ice, right? And you have to remember, right? We think about gravity kind of being, you know, this amount, right? To be, Earth is way, way, way bigger. It's way, way smaller too, right? So the comet is smaller and less massive, but it's sort of things don't quite balance out the same way. You could run the calculation, you know, if you could find the mass of it, figure out what the force of gravity would be. That might be a fun homework problem or a fun exam problem.
Yeah.
Figure out what the force of gravity would be on the surface of this comet. I'm gonna write that one down in my head. Yeah. So comets are cool. Sophia?
What's the size of it?
Of this comet? A few kilometers, I think.
Okay.
This is 500 meters here, this bar.
Yeah.
And I think, like, this is sort of like 30% of the view of this top chunk, more or less.
How fast is it moving?
How fast is it moving?
Like the velocity.
I'm not sure.
I'm just very interested how they go.
It depends on where in its orbit it is, right? You know, the closer you are to the sun, the faster you go. Some of them, they call them sun grazers. They really whip around because they get real close. But, Garrett. 2% of Earth's gravity. There you go. Real time follow up. I like it. On Ceres. So this is going to be tiny, some tiny fraction. Yeah. So if you could find a solid footing, you could probably jump into orbit. I'm serious. I think there's an XKCD about this. You should try and look it up. So here we have this. I think this is a different comet. Maybe it's the same one. Here is some stuff evaporating off the surface. This is where the coma comes from, right? This is the ice evaporating away. And then as that comes out, right, those little particles, they're just tiny little molecules of ice and dust and stuff. As things orbit around the sun, right, you see this dust tail is being pushed away from the sun. Along with the ion tail. This is happening by the process of radiation pressure. This is because photons carry momentum along with them. So the momentum of a photon is the photon's energy, which remember is related to its wavelength or frequency, divided by the speed of light. And the force of that based on momentum is its time derivative. So the force that you get out of a photon is 1 over c times the derivative of energy with time. dE dt is just the luminosity, right? It's how much energy comes out of your star at a given time. So if you go back and you think about the amount of photons you're pushing out from the sun, you can imagine the pressure as being force per area. So if you take that force, 1 over c times dE over dt, and divide by the surface area of the sphere, you find what the radiation pressure is for the sun, which is just whatever the sun's luminosity is, or anything that has luminosity, divided by 4 pi r squared times the speed of light, where r is the distance you are away from the sun. So basically the sun is just sort of all the time pushing out some force with its photons. It's a very, very, very small amount of force. You can do the calculation if you want to sort of take, you know, at a given radius, what's the gravitational force pulling in versus the radiation pressure pushing out. And there's a point at which you can sort of balance those two. You can figure out how far away from the sun that is, which is a fun little problem to do. Okay, so that's how basically you're pushing these tails away from the sun. So that's why they don't just stick with the comet, they get pushed by all this radiation pressure and they end up as long, million kilometer long tails. Sophia?
About these comet pictures?
Yes.
Why are they in black and white? Or like, do they just look like that, or is this just
I believe they are in black and white.
Is that just like a
most spacecraft cameras like this are just in grayscale.
Oh, it's just like a straight up camera.
Because,
it's not
yeah,
even
so,
like a telescope.
So CCDs, yeah, this is from a space mission, right? CCDs that we put on them they don't care about wavelength beyond whether they're sensitive to that wavelength or not. They just collect photons. It doesn't
doesn't care what wavelength they are. You can try and make different colors by putting filters in front to just collect different colors. And so that's where things like the B minus V color comes from. That's looking at blue invisible light. But just if you just have a raw camera, it just is black and white like this. So this might, this is, you know, in reality, it's probably sort of a
gas come from inside it? That's what, like, is that where we're,
yeah, that's
to take
that,
from?
That's melting ice on the surface.
Okay,
it's
so
sort
it's
of
just
jetting
on the surface.
Out. As well. Yeah, because there's no atmosphere for it to diffuse into, right? It's sublimating. That's the word. Any other questions about comets? Yeah.
So over here it says consider a shell of radius r.
Yeah. Yeah.
So are those two separate?
It's the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah, the radius is the distance from the sun.
Okay.
It means the same thing, yeah. I don't think this will come up more than just having to know what radiation pressure is. So. And maybe that equation at most.
Okay. So let's talk about rings now. So we all know about Saturn's rings, right? They're, you know, you've seen them with the telescope now, you've seen pictures of them. They're beautiful, right? They're ears. Galileo drew them, you know, in his notebook as ears. But all the different gas giants in the solar system have rings of some level or another. Saturn's are obviously the most prominent of all of them, but all of them have, Jupiter has basically just one little thin ring. Uranus and Neptune have other smaller sort of rings that they have like little arclets on them and stuff. This is Neptune, this is Uranus, it sort of has this nice one thicker one and then three smaller ones. And you can see here are some other little chunks of things floating around. But obviously Saturn is the main event here, right? This is a picture from Cassini, which is a backlit. This is the sun is behind Saturn, lighting it up from behind, so you can sort of see all the different rings that are here. These are the main rings that we think about as being able to see. And then there are also these other more diffuse ones further out. Is that Earth, right? You remember that little dot?
I think Earth is on the right.
Maybe that thing?
Yeah, that's Earth. Yeah.
That's Earth. Maybe that's Titan. I don't know. This is the sort of cool picture you get from NASA, right? You know, just cool rings. What are rings? I've spoiled the answer, but... They're basically just little tiny chunks of ice. So if you can sort of imagine, this is, if you could go in, zoom far into a ring around Saturn, it might look something like this, where each one of these is a chunk of ice that have some variance in size, right? So the ice particles in Saturn's rings have sizes between like 1 centimeter and 3 meters in size. Not particularly big, right? 3 meters would fit in this room, no problem. There's again gonna be a size distribution where the bigger things are more rare than the small things. And so these are only a few dozen meters thick. And when I say a few dozen, I mean like 30 meters, right? 30 meters is not particularly big on the scale of a planet. If you sort of imagine that the rings are sort of 100,000 kilometers wide, right? If you imagine this is 100,000 kilometers across here.
if you had a sheet of paper that were the thickness of the rings, so, you know, feel the sheet of paper in your notebook, right? That's how thick the rings are in a scale model. That piece of paper is going to be a kilometer across. That's how thick they are compared to how wide they are. So if you were watching Saturn as Earth sort of passes through the plane of the rings, they completely disappear. You can't see them anymore because they're that thin. It's like a razor blade. 30 meters thick is like the height of this building, basically. They're not particularly big, right? So if you could walk through them, no problem, in a minute or two. No big deal, right? There's gaps in the rings, little sort of things that get carved out. You can obviously see some of these gaps here. It looks like this is maybe a dated reference for some of you, a vinyl record, right? They have grooves and gaps and things. There's a particularly notable one here around the outside. This is sort of a dark color thing here. Those are caused by orbital resonances, basically just gravity effects, and things called shepherd moons, where you have moons that are literally taking particles in the rings and keeping them into specific orbits that are available, either by gravity or by literally just collecting that material onto their surfaces. So here's, this is Saturn, again, obviously, this is the moon that's called Pan. And here is Pan up close. Why do we have this weird space ravioli looking thing? Not a potato anymore, it's a ravioli. Why does it look like that? Why does it have this ring of material around its equator there? Talk about it for a minute. How might that have happened?
Because it looks like it's deflating. It looks like you can just squish it.
There's going to be material on the side.
That is really scary. It creeps me out.
Wait, that's a moon.
It's a moon.
So it's big.
It's asteroid-ish. Kilometers big, probably.
It just doesn't give me solid vibes. It gives me like deflating bouncy house vibes.
So are these rings like relatively densely populated?
Yeah.
It's like it would be like a bad idea to like fly a spacecraft through them or something.
Oh yeah.
Okay. So it's not like the asteroid belt where there's like not really any asteroids. Like
it's a lot more dense than that.
You'd have a bad time if you were.
You could probably make it through without like really having to worry too much about it. They're not moving particularly quickly.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, as long as you're in the sea,
you could sort of swim through it, but it's not like it's like a ball pit density. You know, they're not touching each other necessarily all the time. They stick together and stuff, but.
But that's why we didn't tell Cassini to fly anywhere near the rings until we were like done with Cassini.
Okay.
And then we told to fly in between Saturn and his rings, really close.
What's going on with Pan, Nathaniel?
Well, because that ring is so thin, like basically all the material is just going to collapse on the moon and not the plane.
Yeah. It's literally orbiting in the ring, right? It's just picking up that material and it's just stacking up on the outside of that moon. Like pouring flour onto a baking sheet or something, right? It's just, it's taking all those ice particles and just pulling them in with gravity, and they sit there. But there's not enough gravity in this moon to rearrange everything into a sphere. It's not big enough, it's not massive enough. So it just sort of sits there on the surface, making it look like a space ravioli. I just like saying space ravioli. It's fun. So it makes it look weird, right? It's like a mountain range of ice around the ring, around the equator of this moon. Sophia?
You said it was in the rings?
Yeah, it's in the ring.
It's in a gap now.
So it's just
it's
really,
orbiting in the same
really
plane.
Small compared to the rings. Because like that picture on the left, it looks like it's not.
It's thicker, right, than the rings. The rings are 30 meters thick. This moon is probably a kilometer thicker. So.
So it's like
just
this.
Sort of eyeballing it, right?
Like,
but yeah,
these are the rings, and that's it.
Like that, you know. But the rings are hundreds of thousands of kilometers across, so. Steve, you had a question too, right?
Yeah, there's more than one shepherd moon, right?
Uh-huh.
Ham is not the only one.
I mean, they sort of all act as shepherd moons in
yeah.
a way, right? So as long as they're in the same plane as the rings,
right.
they can set up some sort of orbital resonance.
Don't they, like, do something neat with the ice particles? Like, are there, like, wavies?
There's all sorts of cool stuff you can do. So,
there we go.
Here's another one that's in a gap. And it's got some weird oblong shape, and it's spinning. And so what that does is it takes the particles on the edge of the gap and does weird, warpy, wavy things. And so this is, the sun is coming from this direction over here, shining, and you can see the shadows of those waves projected onto the ring. And there's the shadow from the moon, obviously, right? So there are shadows from those waves. And that's gonna look like, you know, some warp up on the edge. There's also these weird patterns, right? Those are orbital resonances in the rings, the sort of light, dark, scaly pattern. There are also other moons that are sort of outgassing the same way that a comet would do, and that produces something that looks like this. There's a ring around Saturn that's more diffuse, and that's the moon inside, right? There it is right there. And so that might be but something more like this is, where you have a ring forming around a big, more diffuse ring forming around the planet. Albert? Yeah. So if we go back to this sort of initial diagram I showed here with the different ring systems, there's this dotted line around the outside called the Roche limit. That's based on the tidal force of the big planet, and it's saying what the radius of an orbit away from the planet is, where the tidal force is stronger than the sort of internal structure force of a rocky body. So it says basically, if a planet comes inside that line, it's disrupted by the tidal force and it can't stay as a solid body anymore. And so it falls apart into tiny particles. And those end up as rings. As they lose their vertical motion through collisions, they bump into each other and they either bounce or stick together, and they don't have any up or down motion anymore. They just have flat motion, the same way the solar system flattened out, right? So that's why they end up in a thin ring. But that Roche limit, usually you don't find many rings outside of that, right? Almost all these rings are outside of or inside of the Roche limit, except this one for Neptune. So that one, that may have formed by some other disruption event. But mostly you won't find them outside that radius.
And
nothing. Nothing. Eventually the rings will evaporate. They only last so long, they're only so stable. So Saturn's rings will eventually go away. I think there was sort of in the last couple of years there was a big study about that, doing simulations, and they found that they don't really have very much longer to last.
on solar system timescales. On human timescales, we don't have to worry about it, but they could sort of disappear pretty easily. They're relatively fragile because they're inside that Roche limit. Things can really easily disrupt them. Sophia?
For like any given planet with rings, for like a given ring, are those generally composed of like things that were much like younger than the planet and then came and were like broken apart, or were some of the things like there with the formation of the planet and just got stuck in the rings instead of on the planet?
Little column A, little column B, depends on what object they're made out of. Really, any planet can have a ring, right? There's nothing to stop the Earth from having a ring. You just need an object that gets disrupted. And then the lifetime of the ring depends on what its composition was as well, right? So if you could somehow manage to pulverize a small asteroid in Earth orbit and not have it like rain onto the surface and kill everybody, it would make a ring probably for a while. Get the orbit stable, but it sort of depends on what's there, what's available. So this, you know, Saturn's rings could be like captured comets or something, something like that.
But it's generally something that like the planet was already there. It doesn't have anything to do with the formation of it.
Yeah, because they don't last quite that long. The time scale of their lifetime is a lot shorter.
So we happen to exist right at the time when Saturn has rings.
Yeah.
See?
Otherwise, I would say there's probably always some amount of ring around a gas giant like this because they have such big tidal forces. But the more common ones are going to be like the other three, where they have sort of small, hard to see things. Like, you know, one little. If you think about it, Earth does have a ring, and it's the geostationary satellites. You know? We're actively maintaining that one.
Any other questions about rings?
Yeah, I've got a question.
Yeah, Eric?
I know the Shepherd moons, they orbit on the same like plane, same inclination as the rings.
Yeah.
They're like inside. Like,
yeah.
So with Saturn and Jupiter, are all the moons like on that same inclination or plane, or do some of them vary more?
I would say generally,
the satellites of a planet fall into a plane the same way the planets of the solar system fall into a plane. Obviously, our moon has a little bit of a tilt, right? It's like 5 degrees off of Earth's orbit. So there's, you know, small amounts of difference in there that you can have, but generally speaking, it's going to be roughly flat.
People generally make the distinction between major moons. The Galilean satellites are the major moons of Jupiter, so they'll orbit in a plane.
Yeah.
But then there's a bunch of irregular moons that can do whatever they want at whatever.
Because
those are most likely captured objects.
Right, and this is why we think a lot of moons are just asteroids that got grabbed by gravity, because some of them go backwards.
Yeah.
Right, you have retrograde moons that go the wrong way. And, you know, that you can't have formed those as part of this planet forming process. Right, they have to be come from somewhere else. So it's this, you know, sort of the same thing, right? It's the, I guess, intrinsic moons that are sort of driving the ring system.
So does Titan interact with Saturn's rings, or is it just not the right
orbit for
that?
Titan's pretty far out, but I'm sure it has some effect and some orbital resonance doing something.
Gotcha.
I'm not sure exactly what, though. Sophia?
So, like, when I picture an asteroid, I probably picture something irregular and or oblong. And then when I picture a moon, I picture spherical. Is that just like a random bias from like how we like categorize and like learn about these things, or if something is a moon long enough, does it like become spherical?
I think how I want you to think about it is major moons, like moons that have names, like names that you probably know. Those are spherical. Minor moons are the same as asteroids. They might have names, but, you know. So those are potatoes. And then some moons in the outer solar system, like Uranus and Neptune, those could be captured comets. And comets are just the same, they're just sort of but they're regular shaped.
I have to clarify my question. So like the things that are spherical in the solar system are spherical because of their rotation and or tidal forces, or so like would that ever happen to a captured asteroid is my question.
The moon, the spherical objects in the solar system are because they are massive enough that their gravitational force overcomes the structural force of their composition. So like rocks have some rigidity to them. So if things are round, if the gravity can overcome the rigidity and reshape the rock into a sphere. So there's some mass threshold that you have to have, which I don't know the number. It depends on the density. But you have to be above that to be a dwarf planet or minor planet or a spherical moon. In the last 5 minutes, one last class of tiny-ish things. And these are Kuiper Belt objects. So if you imagine Kuiper Belt and Oort cloud objects, if you imagine sort of the asteroid belt as being in the plane of the solar system in between Mars and Jupiter, the Kuiper Belt sort of is a roughly similar looking thing that's outside the orbit of Neptune. That contains sort of the same idea, right? You sort of have lumpy space potato things, some big, some really big, small, some smaller, and then mostly really tiny little things. The Oort cloud is not a planar structure. It's a spherical structure. It surrounds the entire solar system. It's made of basically just like comets, and that's where comets come from. It's huge. It like occupies the outer 70% of the volume of the solar system or something. It's got tons of little comets in it. And this is why comets aren't necessarily on orbits that are in the plane of the planet. They come down from above or below or the side. The really interesting things that we found in the Kuiper Belt, those are things like Pluto. And it's kind of weird, vast collection of moons that it has. There's a picture of Pluto from the New Horizons probe, and its biggest moon, you say Charon, Ray, or?
Charon.
Charon?
Yeah, named after the guy's wife.
Pluto and Charon. And then that other one there is New Horizons' other, it's called Arakoth now, is that right? Did they give it a name?
Yes.
That's two space potatoes welded together with some like cheddar cheese or something. Thank you, Sophia. it's you know, ice and rock and stuff, right? So most things in the Kuiper Belt, like Pluto and Charon and Arakoth, are mainly collections of rock and ice. They're more comet-like. Some of them are massive enough to be formed into spheres like Pluto, and there are a handful of other Kuiper Belt objects, dwarf planets, that sort of have the same idea as Pluto. It's just we knew about Pluto first, so it's what we are mostly interested in, and it used to be a planet, and so, you know. One of these years I'll have a class that wasn't alive when Pluto was still a planet. That would be a weird day. But you all were, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Were you in elementary school when it was still a planet?
I learned about it.
A couple of you?
For sure. I was in fifth grade.
What year was it again?
2006.
Oh, I wasn't there. Oh, 2006, okay.
So you were four or five years old?
Yeah.
Jeez. Pluto.
I swear they still told me it was a planet when I was in school.
Well, there were opinions back then. Here's Pluto. This is from behind, the same way that Saturn was lit up from behind in that picture of the rings, right? Here's Pluto from behind, so it's sort of backlit by the sun. You can see Pluto actually has a thin atmosphere around it, which is kind of cool, and you can sort of see mountain ranges, and that's basically just big chunks of ice that are mountain-sized. So these are interesting things, and that's the extent to which we can talk about them. I'm sure the pro-Pluto people are not happy with me giving them 3 minutes of a joke in an undergrad level astronomy class. There we are.
When we come back on Wednesday, we will talk about atmospheres and gas giants. If you are here, if you have to go home for Thanksgiving, enjoy your trip. See you next week. Otherwise, see you on Wednesday.